Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome, Gaias and fans of Voices of the Sacred Feminine across the globe and right here in the United States, where we discuss goddess as deity, archetype, and ideal, the feminine consciousness, right brain thinking, and how women of the West are being called upon to save the world. You know, the Dalai Lama has actually just said that recently. And what a week it's been since our show last week. I personally am coming off of a real high. We had a wonderful class. Woman Power was the topic. It was the next class in our session of Cakes for the Queen of Heaven at the Goddess Temple in Orange County here in Southern California. I think everyone leaving the class was probably walking about 2 inches taller by the time we finished. And it isn't often goddess advocates can so readily draw connections between what's going on in the world today and herstory. But this week was a real exception, because if you tuned in last week or you've been following my Examiner column all week, you know in honor of Valentine's Day, which most of us celebrated Sunday, we've been discussing the more authentic essence of Aphrodite and what she really meant to her people as an archetype and deity, also shedding some light on the practices of those powerful ancient women, those priestesses. February 15th, many moons ago, was the ancient Lupercalia, sometimes associated with celebrations in Rome to honor the goddess Juno Februa in Cybele. These festivals actually morphed later into St. Valentine's Day. And yesterday, Tuesday, was Mardi Gras, or Fat Tuesday in New Orleans with its pagan roots, which I detailed in my column on that I titled New Orleans and Mardi Gras from a Goddess Point of View. And last but not least, many of us no doubt have this week begun to watch the Winter Olympics. So by week's end, I will take the opportunity to share excerpts from my book in the Examiner column, introducing the pre-Olympic goddess games of Greece in honor of Hera, Artemis, and Hecate. The great she is surrounding us this week, embracing us in her golden wings today and yesteryear. And like icing on the cake, or maybe Godiva chocolate, do we have a sweet show for you tonight? I may be thinking creamy milk chocolate with a caramel center myself. That would be my preference. At the top of the hour, our guest is Phyllis Chesler, internationally known activist, attorney, psychologist, feminist icon, and author of many books. The one of particular interest to us tonight is Women's Inhumanity to Women. We'll share more of her extensive credentials in just a few minutes as we chat with her for maybe an hour if we're lucky, or possibly less. We'll see how it goes, how she's feeling tonight. Then at the bottom of the show, at about 7 o'clock, scholar David Hillman will be back. He's calling in. Last week we were discussing how the Christian lens has distorted how we view the Greek goddesses and Greek perceptions and the outlook they had on deity and nature, including particular emphasis on how powerful women of ancient times actually were and the importance of goddess archetypes that have been, for the most part, written out of history for those of us in the West. We might continue that conversation if time allows, but only after we review the movie that came out this weekend, Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief. Now, we're going to look beyond the Harry Potter-like motifs, because Dr. Hillman and I thought it might be really fun to continue to expose the differences between what we think we know about ancient Greece compared to what, to translations that aren't distorted. You know, these conversations we've been having and all our rethinking and reclaiming of these aspects of the sacred feminine, whether it be archetype, ideal, deity, I've been thinking that, you know, maybe that's some of the real frontier of discovery, not just the cosmos, not just the ocean's depths, but rediscovering what has been lost to history or written out, especially the history or herstory and culture of women. So if you missed last week's show, you can catch it or any of our shows from the archives, and please check out my Examiner column and read about the practices of ancient priestesses and the real Aphrodite, who was so much more than that boudoir babe, and how we got pagan Mardi Gras in Catholic New Orleans, too. You know, as a former New Orleanian myself, I spent most of my adult life and childhood not knowing about the pagan roots of Fat Tuesday, so it was quite an eye-opener for me, as it might be for you. Or if you have my book, Sacred Places of Goddess, go to the section in North America on New Orleans as a sacred site, because it's all there. And just a couple more quick things before we get to our guest, Phyllis Chesler, who is patiently waiting on the line, and I thank her for these last few minutes of patience. First, I want to give a shout-out to a couple of my regular listeners, Gary, Michael S., and Sintra, who have been such a delight over email, and to the wonderful artists who so generously allow me to use their music. So here's a plug for some of our friends over in the UK, because that band was a UK band called Be Optimistic. And the snippet of the song you heard, it actually is in honor of Goddess. It's called Maria. And second, I promise I have not forgotten or dropped the What's the Buzz segment that's usually at the bottom of the hour. Some of you have emailed and asked, where is it? We like that. You tell us how to relate goddess ideals to what's happening in the world. Well, like I said, it's usually at the bottom of the hour, but last week was just so juicy and ran long, and this week, because of our unusual lineup of two wonderful guests, I promise the following week What's the Buzz will return, because there is so much to talk about. So many ideals of goddess being violated out there, I have to vent and release the bees buzzing around in my bonnet. So much history and truth being rewritten, and the seeming pride out there being taken in anti-intellectualism and what I call the dumbing down of our fellow Americans. But I'll save it all for next week, so please email in any comments you might have about some of the past shows. But without further delay, let me turn my attention to this week's guest. She is foremother and way shower, Phyllis Chesler. Let me tell you about this incredibly accomplished woman whose work I just admire, just in case you are new to her. Feminist icon Phyllis Chesler is the author of 13 books and thousands of articles and speeches, an emerita professor of psychology and women's studies at City University of New York, a psychotherapist and an expert courtroom witness. She's a co-founder of the Association for Women in Psychology and the National Women's Health Network, as well as a charter member of the Women's Forum and the Veterans Feminists of America. She's lectured and organized political, legal, religious, and human rights campaigns worldwide. Her pioneering work, Women and Madness, the first book to address the egregious double standard for women in psychology, is a long-standing classic. Some of her other books, let me give you some of the titles. Women and Madness, we just said that. Women, Money, and Power, About Men. With Child, A Diary of Motherhood, Mothers on Trial, The Battle for Children in Custody, Sacred Bond, The Legacy of Baby M, Patriarchy, Notes of an Expert Witness, Feminist Foremothers in Women's Studies, Psychology and Mental Health, Letters to a Young Feminist, Women's Inhumanity to Women, which I believe is about to be re-released, or it has been re-released, and that's going to be the topic of our show tonight. Women of the Wall, Claiming Sacred Ground in Judaism's Holy Site. The New Anti-Semitism, The Current Crisis and What We Must Do About It, The Death of Feminism, What's Next in the Struggle for Women's Freedom. On a personal note, in her personal life, she attended Bard College, where for 2 years she had a relationship with a fellow student from Afghanistan. She was briefly married to him in 1961, during which time the couple lived in Afghanistan in the capital of Kabul in the large polygamous household of her father-in-law. She credits this experience with inspiring her to become an ardent feminist, and I'm hoping she'll tell us more about that tonight. And I also want to bring to your attention her wonderful Chesler Chronicles on her website, where we can keep up with what's going on with the status of women around the world. You can go there now. Well, not now, after the interview. Read some of her entries, such as Viva La France, Europeans Take Women's Equality Seriously, Buried Alive in Turkey and Under the Burqa, How a Nice American Girl Became a Jihadist, and The Steady Erosion of Women's Rights in Egypt. Or more closely related to our show tonight, her newest entry that she's only posted recently, Mothers-in-Law, Not a Laughing Matter, about the 10-year-old girl who demanded and received a divorce from her husband, three times older than her, and the cruelty of this young girl's mother-in-law. All of that tonight, so I think you're in for a great treat. Phyllis, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being a guest on Voices of the Sacred Feminine.
You're very welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
So, Phyllis, I've admired your work and your outspoken way-showing. You've provided insight into how some women treat each other badly and why. So, what inspired you to write Women's Inhumanity to Women? Was it the experience living with your mother-in-law in Afghanistan?
Oh, absolutely, totally not. No.
No.
I think it was more a feminist era experience when we, all of us, thought that to be sisters meant we would be best friends and fairy godmothers to each other and would love each other and help each other forever in every way. Completely unrealistic, but we all were in love with that possibility because it was absent from our previous real lives. And then we discovered one by one the phenomenon that we called trashing, which is now many, many decades later known as mean girl behavior. And that means that even our feminist ardor didn't get rid of the competition, jealousy, envy, sabotage, slander, gossip, and trashing, indirect aggression and direct competition that women, even feminist women, went through. So when, maybe after about 12 years as a feminist leader, certain things happened that even I had to admit were a problem. I mean, I couldn't deny it. I couldn't wish it away. I couldn't overcome it. I couldn't leap over it. And so probably in about 1980, which was 13 years into feminism for me at that time, I began researching this book. And over a 20-year period, I interviewed a lot of women and I read very widely. And many feminists along the way said, don't do this book. This book will hurt us. Men will use it against us. And then after some time passed, those very same women would say, well, when is your book coming out? Or why didn't you do it already? Or we could have used it in 1969. But there was a nervousness about it because to even look at women, I mean, like men, women internalize sexism. And then add to that whatever permissible competition we are expected to display towards other women, not towards men. Towards other women, the feminist line in the beginning, the politically correct line in the academy, was that women are very sweet and very victimized and very pure and practically perfect and better than men, morally superior. And so to say, well, wait a minute, but women are racist too. And yeah, women are sexist also. And women will steal your boyfriend and steal your girlfriend and steal your job with absolutely no shame.
Mm-hmm.
Where could a feminist paradigm, which correctly also looked at all the ways in which women are capable of intimacy and heroism and brilliance, you know, so feminists early on couldn't say, well, we're human beings, so we're both. Mm-hmm. We're not one or the other. We're both.
Right, right.
So that we can really choose what we want to do.
Well, Phyllis, is it simply that we're human beings, or do you think it's partly to do with maybe the patriarchal programming of women to compete with one another?
Well, you know, that's an important question. I think it's because we're human, and that means we're flawed at the roots. And we have free will, we have free choice, but look at the first chapter. I took a chance and I looked at some of the primate literature, and it's very shocking and hilarious. Primates, female primates, will behave, they'll kill another female primate's baby so that they can then impress her into being the babysitter for their infant.
Oh, geez.
No, I mean, you have to look at this stuff.
It's in the DNA.
Well, none of you think, gee, that's class warfare right there.
Right.
And so that doesn't mean that we're primates. We're human. But what it might suggest is that we could be, at some level, hardwired for certain animal-like behaviors. I mean, I don't want to insult the animals, though. Cruelties. And
A survival issue?
Yes, yes, yes. Now, there's other primates, you know, where there's love, you know, same-sex love among the bonobos. I'm not a primatologist, so that there is probably a lot of diversity. But there's also enough alarming, think back to Les Miserables, the novel and the musical and so on. And I write about that in that same chapter. You have a heroine, Fantine, a tragic heroine, who is drummed out of her little factory job by other women set in France, and who know that her losing this job means that she'll have to turn to prostitution and then no doubt will be dead early. Women do these things.
Well, you know, you talked about... Well, at least I was reading on the internet about that experience you had with your mother-in-law, and then we have this 10-year-old girl that you just wrote about. Women seem to keep perpetuating this cruelty to women. Do you feel comfortable elaborating on your personal experience and maybe compare it to this, you know, this young woman in the Middle East and what she's been going through? And
right.
Case our listeners.
Well, no, what I would say is because I lived under an Islamic gender apartheid regime, unlike most Westerners, I don't romanticize it. I don't glamorize it. I was certainly drawn to it, and there's certain charming features that it may have had a little bit in the past, but make no mistake, this is barbarism. And I saw female slavery. I saw male slavery. I saw, just as we may have it here, I saw women beat their female servants and curse them and treat them as badly as the men treated them.
Well, were they just mimicking what they had seen the men do?
Yeah, the buck has to stop somewhere.
Well, yeah.
You cannot always say, man made me do it. Man is bad, woman's good. You have to say, if my mother abused me, I have a choice not to abuse my daughter. I can't say she made me do it. So, yes, this particular mother-in-law, I think, had a bitter, difficult life as the first wife, and I think it maddens her. But this is true for most women in that circumstance. And it doesn't mean, by the way, if you look at who is enforcing the female genital mutilation, it's women in the service of patriarchy. Who's enforcing the way that the veil is worn in Iran on behalf of the Iranian fascist totalitarian regime? Women.
Well, are they doing it to, you know, earn points with the regime?
In Saudi Arabia? Well, but see, the thing is, we can look at it, then we have to say the same is true of men. That the men who beat up the Democrats marching for freedom in the streets are doing it because it's their paycheck and they want to feed their kids. we have to say that the men who are raping women in the torture chambers are in Iran specifically, or in Saudi Arabia specifically, are doing it because if they didn't do it, then the men above them would do that to their wives and mothers. At some point, you hold an adult human being morally accountable for what they do.
Well, I would think so. And I mean, and I can't even imagine a mother perpetuating these things on her daughter.
No
or,
choice.
That, you know,
they would say that they perpetuate things like this so that their daughters remain pure, their daughters get married, their daughters have happy lives.
But do you think they really believe that?
Yes.
I mean, or they figured it was good enough for me, so it's good enough for you.
That's true, too. Well, it's both. It's they understand that there are no better options at the present time, and whatever that time may be. And, you know, they genitally mutilated me. You're not going to get away with it. Who do you think you are? So very few women, whether – and think of it psychologically, when women in the West – can only go so far because they were not allowed to go further. They don't have an easy time of it giving full steam of head to the next generation who can go further. They're a little bit envious. They're a little bit filled with self-pity, perhaps.
Or resentment.
You know, resentment, jealousy, as in women are human beings. So I don't think we can just say, oh, it's the patriarchy, and then that's the end of it, because we have so much of the patriarchy within us as women.
Well, we're patriarchy in a skirt.
Yes. Yes, yes, exactly, exactly.
So what do you recommend women do aside from being aware of it, which, you know, it's so important that you shed the cleansing light on this? I mean, you know, so what do women do? How do we turn the corner?
Okay, the first, and I think that there are things that every woman listening can do and do right away, and it will be ultimately revolutionary. And the first thing is we have to acknowledge that this is true, as opposed to denying it and saying, well, not me, not the women I know, not the women I work with, not my mother, because I've heard all that it's normal. A human trait to be aggressive is a normal human trait, and women tend to be indirectly aggressive. That means instead of punching somebody in the nose, although women do that more and more today, we gossip about her and ruin her reputation and get others to shun her and dislike her. That's how women are aggressive. That's our great social power. And we also, all right, so we have to admit that we're human. And then I think we have to become both strong and tolerant, because women don't do well with women who are very different from themselves. They want everyone to dress the same way, think the same way, look the same way. And it's really important to develop the habit of tolerating or celebrating difference. And then you won't feel personally betrayed. Women take everything personally, certainly me too, when somebody really does something quite different than what you would do or holds a point of view that you don't agree with. So women take everything personally, and we get very threatened by difference because we read it as abandonment, potential abandonment. We have to learn to, in this regard, probably become a little bit more emotionally moderate, which is not easy because we're wired for deep intensity. And this would also mean that when we get angry, put it out there and let it go. Don't hold a grudge. Women smile. Don't say really that we're pissed and we're angry, and then we never speak to that other woman again. So we need to modify our intense intimacy, which is really going against our female nature a bit. And I think women have to ask for what we want and learn to move on if we can't get it, instead of banging on the rock for water.
What do you, I mean, when I first contacted you, I think I shared with you that one of the reasons I found your work so important to me was because, I mean, I've had more women cause me pain than men. And, you know, and as I've started to, you know, get out a little bit more publicly with books, radio show columns, this sort of thing, I've met other women who are doing a lot of the same things. And, you know, we've sort of confided in one another that, gee, you know, some of our friends who we really thought were our friends now don't want to talk to us, or for some reason we're not one of them anymore. You know, we've sort of been ostracized, or, you know, it's almost as if, I don't know, there's, you know, there's this jealousy or this resentment. And so it sort of forces you, I think, to, you know, to sort of, you know, go in a different direction and try to avoid people that, you know, that these things don't come up for, you know.
Well,
that maybe
you
aren't
can't, you can't, you can't avoid it so easily. What you've just described, I talk about in terms of the cheerleader phenomenon. Marilyn Monroe had no friends, no female friends. And what happens junior high school level, is that when a girl stands out in beauty or in brains, and the other girls feel then cast in a lesser light, they cut her loose. They turn their backs on her. They say bad things about her because they're jealous. So indeed, when gossip starts, it's often gossip against a strong woman who's achieving something. I mean, in an office setting.
Well, you know, I have to tell you, I don't know whether you've heard something so direct and blunt as this, but I'll share it. And this is the goddess honest truth. You know, I actually spoke to a woman one day who I had heard that sort of stuff had been, you know, going on, you know, in the ethers, you know, the gossip and the insidious stuff. And I went up to her and I said, Is this really happening? Can it be true? I thought we were all sisters. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, that's what women do when they get together. You know, I almost fell on the floor. I mean, yes, she was being honest with me, and maybe I was the idealist. But, you know, that was such a reflection of what we're talking about here. And it's like, even though she could say that to me, it was like, well, why not break this cycle? Why let this be the norm?
I agree with you 100%. I think that each woman has it in her power not to repeat the gossip. It can stop with you. If you hear it, you don't have to pass it on. And I mean, it's okay to talk about a woman who's not there if your intention is concern or respect for her, or in some way to help her. It's not. But if your concern is to damage her reputation or ruin her life, or to punish and sabotage someone whom you envy by slandering her, then stop it. And this, men gossip as much as women, men talk as much as women do, they just don't take it so much to heart as we do.
Well, I was going to ask you that because, you know, I always had this impression. I've never heard men gossip personally, you know, but I've seen men go slug it out in the, you know, in the parking lot, and then they shake hands and they're buddies. So
exactly.
They have a beer, but women won't do that.
I've written about that. We have to learn some things from men, actually. Such as then you, some version of duking it out and then letting it go. So you don't then not only hold a grudge forever, but if another woman does something wrong, we turn her from the good fairy godmother we needed her to be into the evil stepmother overnight at the instant, and we never talk to her again, or we speak only badly of her, and there's no middle ground. Men, at least, I first saw this, and I write about this, when my son was about 8. And he would come home after school with a little group of boys, and they would go out in the backyard and start beating each other up. And I thought, I guess they'll never be back. But they were back the next day, because that's what they did. Now, there were little girls on the block. Little girls would arrive very carefully and neatly in paired. There would be two together. And then, very soon, one would be disappeared, and there would be a new best friend. And the old best friend was discarded. And, you know, I analyze, what is this behavior? It's a way of having your mother and letting your mother go, getting rid of your mother, growing up beyond your mother. But little girls do that, grown women do that too. And grown women need many best friends, not just one best friend.
Well, Phyllis, speaking about this mother sort of, I guess maybe let's call her archetype, one of my listeners actually emailed in, what she said was, she's, you know, so oftentimes leaders, you know, it's been her experience to observe, and I gather probably she's experienced this herself, sometimes leaders of a group or a community or something like that, they find that oftentimes a member of the group has to demonize the leader in order to sort of cut the umbilical cord and walk away. Is that something that's legitimate in psychology? Is that a human behavior that happens often? You know, to go on with your adult life or to carve a new path, you have to demonize the other person?
Well, you don't have to, but we know it as an adolescent rebellion. You act up, you act out, you take on authority, you have your spring right, and then hopefully you grow up and you reconnect with your mother. Now, I had to write 3 chapters in Woman's in Humanity to Woman about the mother-daughter relationship because it is so profound. And one of the things that I wrote about that is rarely touched on is envious mothers and talented daughters. That means mothers who've been left behind and who could not realize themselves or their destinies or potential, and daughters who did nothing but that. It's a very interesting chapter. I recommend it.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. So in that regard, the talented daughter has to almost cut her limb off to get out of the trap. And I'm thinking here of Sylvia Plath, and I'm thinking of Maria Callas, and I'm thinking of Camille Claudel, the sculptor who ended up institutionalized for life in a loony bin because her mother put her there, because she was too bohemian and promiscuous or an embarrassment to her bourgeois mother. So mothers persecute daughters now. All mothers all the time? No. But if you think of how mothers have been, go back 100 years, go back 50 years, how a mother looks, her daughter has to look perfect, like she has to look, and if not, something's wrong with the mother. So, and then add to that brew sexual behavior or intellectual behavior, and the idea that mothers are, no, I don't think mothers are abusive. I don't think most mothers abandon their children. I think most mothers really do the job that humanity, you know, has set out for mothers to do. But do mothers belittle their daughters? Do they criticize them? Do they fail them? Yep.
Yes.
Yes. Do they envy them? Do they try to block their path? Yes, do they? And you know what? Not because they don't love them. At some level, mothers, it's the core. It's the, you don't want Persephone to leave. I mean, Demeter cut a deal that she would have her daughter remerge with her for 6 months of the year every year. Most mothers have that same desire. This daughter's getting away. She's running after this man, Hades, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So one way to keep a daughter tied to your side is to tell her she's stupid and ugly.
Mm.
And she won't amount to anything.
And I would imagine there's also, like, for the mothers who had limited, you know, limited opportunities because of maybe the time period they grew up in, you know, maybe they're trying to live vicariously through their daughter and, maybe not so much controlling them, but, you know, trying to get a little bit of that life they couldn't get for themselves.
Well, then there's the stage mother. And by the way, I don't mean to sound like mothers are bad and daughters are great. Daughters break their mothers' hearts. They choose their fathers over their mothers. They prefer, they love their fathers. Hold on 1 minute. A little bit dry here. And they don't admire their mothers, and they don't want to repeat their mothers' destinies. So it's a very two-way street. It's not just one way. And if you go back to fairy tales, and I have a chapter on it, and also Greek myths and as well as fairy tales, who do you think the stepmother really is? She's the part of your mother that you can't bear and that terrifies you, but you can't really admit it or say so, because she might kill you, and besides there's the other part that's feeding you and clothing you and singing you lullabies. Or she's your mother-in-law with whom you live. Or she's your father's second or third or fourth wife, because the other wives died in childbirth.
So it's a very, very complicated, interrelationship
yes.
here we're talking about. It's
yes.
nothing simple.
Exactly.
Well,
let me say one more thing, because
sure.
from your previous question, what is it that women can do?
Yes.
Given that it is so complicated, women need to treat each other respectfully. We need to say thank you when it's like you come home and the house is clean again and there's dinner on the table and nobody ever says, wow, Mom, you did it again. Thank you. All right. So people, women, don't always thank other women for the good that we do, however small or however large. And we don't always treat each other in a civilized manner. And I say a very radical idea is we don't have to love each other. We don't have to love each other. We don't even have to like each other. What we have to do is respect each other. And in order to respect another woman, you have to sure learn to respect yourself.
Well, now, I understand that you have some exercises and things in women, in Humanity to Women. Is that correct?
Exercises? No, no. No, no. I have a new introduction that just came out in 2009.
Okay.
But I don't have... No. Would you like me to do some exercises?
I got that from one of my listeners who said, tell her to talk about the exercises in her book.
Oh, my God. No. I have woven throughout the book is the kind of advice or the kind of rules or the kind of suggestions and analyses that I've just been making.
Okay.
So, but I wouldn't call them exercises.
Well, maybe it was just her choice of words.
Yes.
Well, and interesting that you brought up Persephone and Demeter, and I just got finished teaching a class, Cakes for the Queen of Heaven, and it was about relationships between mothers and daughters, and they used Demeter and Persephone as the archetypes. And, you know, in the end of the class, basically, you know, one of the affirmations was, you know, Goddess affirms healthy relationships between mothers and daughters.
Mm-hmm.
And since we are all daughters, and we all consider ourselves mothers, whether we have birthed children or books or ideas or movements, then you can extrapolate that to say Goddess affirms healthy relationships among women.
Absolutely. And daughters commit matricide. I mean, I don't want to get into Clytemnestra and Electra, although I write about it here, you know, in depth, but we need to do so many opposite things simultaneously. We need to free ourselves from enslaving or the sort of the Demetrian mother that wishes to reabsorb us into her uterus. We need to be free of that. On the other hand, we really need not to kill her. We need to keep her alive and well within ourselves and in life. We need to do some very complicated psychological, psychic things. And I write about this throughout. So we have Demeter and Persephone. Persephone is a very mute, very passive, very mysterious, hidden, unevolved daughter figure. That's not what we want. But then we move on to Clytemnestra and Electra, who conspired to kill her mother. And I think that in many ways, daughter figures of any age do commit matricide when they say of another woman's work, well, that's not so good. I could have done that better. Who does she think she is?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. And when daughter figures of any age look at women leaders or women role models or mother figures, path breakers, and they say, I didn't like her. She wasn't that smart. You know, didn't work for me.
Uh-huh.
You know, I wouldn't have done it that way.
Well, you know, I love when they play Monday morning quarterback and, you know, criticize something someone else has, you know, put their lifeblood into. And what have they accomplished? Sometimes they haven't accomplished too much. You know, they haven't risked putting their neck out there.
Alas.
But they're, you know, want to chop somebody else's off in an instant, you know.
And we're talking about women.
Yeah.
And this is precisely the conversation that women need to have, but... And this is not the same as saying, well, I knew it all along, women are bitches. That's not the conversation I'm recommending. So, and we're not having that. So to grapple with, to really wrestle with the nature of being human and therefore not perfect and therefore very flawed, and then if you want to throw on that fire, oppressed, you know, or battered, I mean, all the other things that can happen, impoverished, you know, overworked, underpaid.
Well, we're the ones scrambling for the, you know, fighting each other for the scraps at the bottom of the heap, as, you know, how many of us describe it.
Yes, yes. Or as I remember Sonia Johnson described it, as lobsters won't let any lobster climb up out of the cage.
Yeah.
So that is also true. But I would recommend, look at what I've written about who Cinderella really is, according to some very soulful philosophers. I end the book looking at Cinderella's goodness and how consoling and crucial goodness is. And now I must say, I've stayed a bit longer, but I do have to go.
Well, thank you, Phyllis. I really appreciate your time. And just to remind listeners that your Women's in Humanity to Women is now available with a new introduction.
Yes.
And I would imagine you can get it absolutely anywhere.
Yes. By the way, I'm a psychologist. I work with lawyers, but I'm not a lawyer.
Okay.
I had to say that.
Okay, well, I stand corrected, so I'm glad to know that. Well, thank you very much for the work that you're doing out in the
thank
world.
Thank you very much, too.
And I hope you're feeling well soon.
It was a very nice conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values or benchmarks just might save the world. And our guest tonight was the delightful foremother, Phyllis Chesler. She's an activist, psychologist, feminist, and author of many books, but one of her most important, Women's in Humanity to Women. I think we all can learn a lot from that book, so highly recommend it. And David Hillman is going to be coming on probably in the next few minutes here. So while we wait for David, I am going to share with you some important announcements. First of all, I would like to let you know that Thursday, tomorrow, February 18th, if you're in the Southern California area, Vajrama is going to be at the Goddess Temple of Orange County. And Vajra has been a leader in the goddess spirituality movement since the 80s. Yet she says, I had been walking the path of goddess for nearly 20 years before this particular string of words came to my mind, women's natural spiritual authority. That's actually the name of the presentation she's giving tomorrow night, the natural spiritual authority of women. She said she encountered feminist author Vicki Noble's term female spiritual authority and probably tucked it away in a corner of her mind. But the word natural in the context of spiritual authority catalyzed a cascade of connections and realizations that reverberated in her body and has continued to multiply and expand even as she writes her book. Well, Vajra has just come back from the Women of Wisdom Conference where this workshop was received very well. So if you're thinking you'd like something to do besides watch the Olympics tomorrow night or reruns on television, check out Vajrama at the Goddess Temple of Orange County. There's going to be a slideshow, an experiential lecture for women only with a guided meditation based in the tantric dance of feminine power. So that's Thursday, tomorrow. Then Monday, February 22nd, Dr. Elizabeth Warsaka will give an illustrated lecture at the California Museum of Art in Beverly Hills, California, and the lecture is titled Queen of the Gods, Mistress of the Two Lands, Great of Dread, the Goddess Moot and her Theban Temple. One of the least known temples at Karnak, the Moot Temple, located in Luxor on the Nile's East Bank, was the center of the goddess worship from at least the reign of the 18th dynasty, female pharaoh Hatshepsut. Not as vast as the adjacent temple of Amun-Ra, it was nevertheless part of the ritual complex devoted to the Theban triad of gods, Amun-Ra, Moot, and Khonsu, who were regarded as father, mother, and son, respectively. Interesting, a trinity before Christianity's trinity. Interesting to note. So that's Monday, February 22nd in Beverly Hills. If anyone's interested, you can call 818-762-5500 regarding attending part of their winter lecture series. And then let's see, we have on February 27th, coming up at the Goddess Temple again down in Southern California, the first turning, the shift from Goddess to God. That's the next class in the Cakes for the Queen of Heaven series that's running down there. Queen of Heaven series is a seminar series in feminist theology. I'm actually the teacher, and I've been having a great time. It's $25 a class, and all the proceeds go to the temple to pay the rent and the light bill and the insurance and everything else to keep things on. And you can attend either an individual class, there are 11 in the series, or you can attend them individually, so you're not committed to come to each one. So, as I said, February 27th is the first turning, the shift from Goddess to God. Then March 13th, we have Reclaiming Women's Heritage of Power. In that class, we talk about the peace of ancient matristic civilizations and ending the violence in our personal and global lives. Then the session takes a break for a month so that we can restore, rethink, and reclaim. And the second part of the series starts. And on May 8th, when we return, that session is about the Hebrew goddess. And then May 22nd is Sarah the priestess. June 12th is the Apostle Mary or Mary Magdalene. June 26th is the Virgin Mary. Then July 10th is witchcraft. And July 24th is intentioned, the new world view that has emerged in recent decades, our hope for ourselves, for the institutions of our society, and we share our dreams of the future. Then at the very end, we're going to have a graduation party as we celebrate our sacred educations. Sunday, February 28th, there's going to be a Sunday workshop given by Joan Norton, author with Margaret Starbird of the book that came out not that long ago called 14 Steps to Awaken the Sacred Feminine. Women in the Circle of Mary Magdalene and Mary Magdalene Within. That's going to be held at from 11 to 3 at Elder Palm Sanctuary. That's in Vista, California, so going a little bit further south of Los Angeles, but north of San Diego. It's $45 for this event, and if it's paid by February 21st. And if you'd like information about that, you can go to jnorton4@socal.rr.com. The website MaryMagdalenWithin.com and hear more about this workshop with Joan Norton. Joan is really a delight. I know her personally. She is going to actually team teach with me the Cakes for the Queen of Heaven class about the Apostle Mary on June 12th. So two opportunities to meet Joan, I think. You really will enjoy that. Let's see. As we wait for David, I think I am going to let listeners have a short music break. And please don't go away. When we come back, David and I are going to talk about the Percy Jackson movie. We're going to talk about stuff like what is a myth and why you know, why did one of the characters in the movie insist that the myth was not a myth but real? We're going to talk about who was Zeus and what is the lightning bolt of Zeus actually about? Lots of interesting stuff. What is prayer? Why is Greek myth not about me? Who were the first demigods? We're also going to talk about Persephone in the movie as well. So I will let you enjoy a little bit of music here by Lane Redman called The Final Delphic Oracle. And we will be back in just a few minutes. And by then, I believe David will have called in and we'll start the second part of our show.
Above all things, speak the truth. Do nothing to excess. Accept the gifts the gods have given you. Choose not the advice of others. Make your own nature your guide in life. The king. The well-crafted temple has fallen to pieces. Apollo dwells here no more. There is no more oracular laurel. No talking spring. And the voice of the water has been silenced. All is finished. Be heard again.
listeners. I hope you enjoyed some of that music I was sharing with you by Lane Redman called the Final Delphic Oracle. And since we are sticking to a theme about Greece tonight, I see our second guest, one of your favorite guests, a Voice of Sacred Feminine, is here on the line with us. David, can you hear me?
Yes, Karen. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine. Actually, you know, I didn't know that my previous guest, Phyllis Chesler, had fallen and broken her leg, and she actually couldn't fill the full hour because she was in so much pain.
Oh.
So anyway, we could have actually started a bit earlier, but you know, she was a trooper for actually, you know, not canceling the show altogether. But our interview ran a little short, so I was sticking to the Greek theme and letting listeners listen to Lane Redman's Delphic Oracle from her new CD. So,
fantastic. Well, you know what? We'll jump in now and do a little discussion.
Okay. So listeners, as you heard last week and you heard the intro, David and I thought it might be fun to sort of play Siskel and Ebert. Now, like I told you, David, when we were talking about this, I forget which of us is going to be Siskel and which of us is going to be Ebert. I'm not sure.
You know, yeah, I can't remember which is which.
You know, I can't either. I know it was the kind of big guy and the thin guy, and I used to love listening to them. So I hope our listeners have as much fun with us tonight.
Good, I hope so too.
But just as a reminder to our listeners, David is a doctor and a scholar, and he's the author of The Chemical Muse, Drug Use and Roots of Western Civilization. And the reason why David is such an authority on all of this is because he can actually translate these ancient texts. He doesn't have to rely on other people to translate for him, and you know, he isn't hindered by that Christian lens so many of the texts are seen through. So we thought it might be fun to look at the movie that started this weekend, Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief. And we know it was kind of a kids' movie, but we thought it might be fun to have David talk to us about what we saw on the screen and what we think we understand about ancient Greece and their outlooks versus what was actually more authentic. So I guess, David, maybe I'd like to start by asking you, how close did they come to, would the Greeks have been proud? Let's put it that way. Did they come close or, you know, they off base?
You know, I think I'm just going to throw this out there, and your listening audience probably knows that I'm a little bit crazy already, but, you know, I think if we're going to look at anything about whether or not the Greeks would be proud, we look at the line that somebody had in the movie. I forget exactly who said it, but they said, you know, oh, it was Chiron. He said, hey, you know, those myths that people used to talk about, you know, what if they were real? You know, you have to understand that they were real. And I think that shows right away. That's a perfect example of the Christian lens, because no Greek would ever have gone around, woman, man, or child would have ever gone around and said, was this real? Did this guy actually exist, and did he have a feet and hands and arms?
But now, you're saying that because to the Greeks there was no doubt that they were real?
No, because there was no belief that they were real.
They were just the energy. They were the essence of nature, correct?
Well, because they didn't know. You hit at the heart of the matter, but it's even more basic than that. I think you can look at it, because when we look at the Christian lens, we're looking at faith essentially, and faith is not a virtue in the Greco-Roman world. It's just not. Reason is a virtue. So these gods that the Greeks and Romans talked about could be reasoned. So you didn't have to believe in them. You don't have to believe in desire. Whether or not you like desire or not, it's still going to affect your life. And like you said, these are the essences of things that are real, like desire, for example. And so they didn't need that. There was no question of whether or not do we have to have faith. And I think that's what really this movie really projected, was that the premise is, hey, what if these gods, what if these myths, were actually real? Well, a myth in antiquity is an expression. It's a phrase. It's a sentiment. It's an aphorism can be a myth,
Or it's an analogy. It's it's a guide mark to help us identify values that we want or don't want in our life, right?
Exactly. And again, back to what you said, you hit at the core of it, because they were looking at these things as real things. I mean, does desire? I like to use that one because we talked about Aphrodite last time. Does desire exist, or does repulsion exist? Or does music exist? I mean, you can't have faith in music. And when
because you just know it's there.
Well, right. I mean, you know, exactly.
It's not a matter of faith.
Right, exactly. There is no faith in the ancient world. You don't have to have faith. There is no prerequisite of, there's no dogma. There's no doctrine. You know, the Greeks didn't go around with you know this as well as I do, and I think your audience probably already knows it as well, but there's no values. There's no, hey, we have a creed that you have to follow, and if you don't believe in it, well, you're doomed to an eternity of X, Y, or Z. So, yeah, when Chiron said in the movie, I realized right away, oh, okay, people are looking at, the producers and the directors and the actors are all creating this movie on under the false assumption that the Greeks believed any of this. There's no question of belief.
Okay. All right. So I think, I'm getting this now. Okay, because you were having to spoon feed me a little bit, myself. So while the producers are treating this like, there's no doubt about if this is real, the Greeks would never have thought about this as real.
Exactly. Why, you know, is music, do you have to have faith in music? That's exactly right. And don't, again, Karen, you always hit at the very heart of the issue, because you have an understanding. You have a pipeline to that inspiration, I think, that a lot of people can see in you and can feel in you. And you hit to the matter exactly as it is. And that is, hey, these are essences. These are things that people, you know, it's not what if. The premise of the movie is what if Medusa is, this snake-headed creature, and, you know, Uma Thurman played her, and, you know, great, and, you know, she takes off the glasses, and the eyes are there, and she turns people to stone and whatnot. It's not as if the audience has to trick itself, because we're Christians, you know. We have to trick ourselves into saying, oh, okay, well, we know that this doesn't actually exist, but what if it did? But to the Greek mind, or to the mind of the people who created, you know, the Greek priestesses, for example, there's no question of belief or disbelief. Music is music, and if you want to harness that music, if you want to harness the female intuition, the female vision that the Greeks so praised, you don't need to believe it anything.
So in other words, like, all right, so go into the Greek priestesses. The Greek priestesses, faith was not part of one of the things they needed to be priestesses, because they were aware of the essence of the deity and nature. I mean, it surrounded them every day. It was, they had this this deeper inner connection that we've lost because of our Christian lens.
Exactly.
Okay, I think I got it. All right, so Aphrodite, tell us about her translation as a Christian lens. I think you wanted to talk a little bit more about that. I mean, we're not getting off the subject of the movie, but I think you felt like you left something out about Aphrodite last week, and since we're still on Greece, let's throw her in now.
Sure. So when we look at the hymns, say, some of the earliest texts for Greek, to talk about Greek gods, are that what you call Homeric hymns, and these are archaic hymns that praise gods and goddesses for different things. Anyway, in the hymn to Aphrodite, let me just read you this English translation.
Okay.
It says, "Thereupon, smile-loving Aphrodite fell in love with him," says Anchises, "at sight, an immoderate longing seized her mind." So Aphrodite's being made, the story is Aphrodite is being made to feel desire for somebody, just like she does to all the gods and mortals. She causes them to feel desire. Well, Zeus gets fed up with this, and he makes her feel desire. And the translator, the English translator, translates this as Aphrodite fell in love and was seized with immoderate longing.
So are they trying to say lust?
Yeah, exactly. So, and that's why do we do that? Because that's the picture of Aphrodite through the Christian lens. She is lust. But what does the text actually say? It doesn't say she fell in love. There's no, there's absolutely no word for love or for any sort of process of falling in love. It doesn't exist. What the text actually says is she wanted him, and she was totally overcome. It's kataphrenos. Her mind was bent.
Obsessed.
It was, yes. It was obsessed. It was overcome. It was conquered by himeros, by desire.
Okay, but that's too shameful for the Christians, so that's why they sugarcoated it.
Well, yes, and not only do they sugarcoat it, but they make her look like it's some kind of bad act. It's some kind of, well, it's, you know, immoderate, you know, immoderate. No, Aphrodite is overcome by her own desire, and she wants him. At that point, she wants, and later she doesn't want him. She kind of brushes him off and tells him he's an idiot. And, you know, and she, you know, basically says, hey, you're a good guy, and I'm going to protect your son and everything, but that's all I'm going to have to do with you. And don't ever tell anyone we slept together, or I will kill you.
So really what you're saying is the Greeks' mores, the Greeks' their rule book didn't really fit with the Christian lens. So the Christians sort of skewed it so it was more acceptable according to what they believed was acceptable. I mean, in other words, Aphrodite's acts to them would have been shameful rather than natural, perhaps. You know, something that the average human being experiences, this longing, this lust or whatever. But they you know, they couldn't just say it like it was.
Exactly. That longing is deemed bad by Christianity because sex is deemed is controlled by Christianity. And you see this in the early Christian centuries, and of course, because you have a male-dominated clergy, then you get this kind of male-centered control of the sexual act itself, and you get kind of a misogyny, a really strong. Now you don't kind of get a misogyny; you get a real misogyny. But yes, they completely cut out this aspect of life that nature has given, desire. You know. One thing I didn't mention on last show that I wanted to give your audience, this is a real gem. The word anthos is kind of bloom. It means bloom or something coming to fruition, something at the peak of its existence. You know, it's there to do something. It's there to bloom. And this bloom is what we oftentimes, you know, sex is considered to be a piece of the blooming act of humanity, and so of course the desire, you know, the plant wants to draw you, you know, it wants to draw you into the bud, it wants to create life, and so in doing so, it has to create that draw. The Greeks understood this, the Romans did too. They understood this, and so that draw really gained like a cult status in antiquity. For you to worship the bloom was for you to really respect what the highest thing that nature could possibly do.
We're talking about the life force. I mean, that desire leads to procreation. And that used to be. I mean, especially when you're thinking about in ancient times, when infant mortality rates were high, women died in childbirth frequently. I mean, we didn't have the grocery store to go get our food. You know, you had to hope that the weather was going to be good, so the crops would grow, so you could feed your animals, so you could eat them, and you know, this domino effect. So this, I don't know. Am I missing the mark here? But this natural act of desire, you know, sort of kept life going.
Exactly, and you don't have to you don't have to limit it to procreation, because say desire between two women or desire between two men, that was considered the same blooming. It was considered, you know. People will die for what they desire. They will give their lives for what they desire. And say, look at Sappho, and you look at what we have to know about women teaching young girls in antiquity. It was it was common for there to be a relationship. We know this with Sappho, for the women to develop relationships with their pupils, sexual relationships. And these relationships were considered to be a method of, or a way of teaching that you really couldn't get without that attraction. That attraction, that desire actually fed into the education of the individual. It made something bigger. So to limit it to procreation, no, procreation definitely. That's the act itself of producing life is sacred. And, hey, that's something that they've worshipped, the Greeks worshipped for, you know, that's the one of the oldest forms of worship. But that desire doesn't have to be limited to actually producing offspring. And I think, again, the Christian lens is we think one man, one woman, copulating and producing a child, and that act is sacred. And if you interfere, if a woman interferes and tries to, say, abort a fetus that a man has helped her to produce, then that's considered kind of a sacrilegious, anti-God sort of thing. But for the Greeks, that has nothing to do with anything. The act itself is life. And I think I'll get off my podium and get to the next point. We'll get to the next point. I'm sorry. But
No. Go ahead. This is great.
It's so important because as a molecular biologist, I studied genes for years. And I can tell you for a fact, there is one principle in nature that really is overwhelming, and that is desire. You have to have desire if you're going to have genetic success. You have to have a draw. There has to be a reason behind the gene that pushes it to overcome other possible genes. It's an evolutionary thing. You can't get beyond it, that life constantly struggles to improve itself, to produce, to create. And in order to do that, the genes themselves scream out for that. Even on a molecular level, with the proteins that they make and what they do, much of it becomes about desire. So
it's this magnetism that really keeps, sort of keeps the forces of the universe going.
Exactly. And that's how the Greeks looked at it. It is a universal force. And if you don't understand the physics of it, and again, these girls were studying here, and they were studying what we would call physics. They were studying geometry, and they were studying basic astronomy, more sophisticated astronomy than I know, that's for sure, because, you know, you have to predict things like eclipses and stuff like that, and I don't know about you, but I can't predict an eclipse at all.
No, astronomy is not my strong suit. I have to tip my hat to those ancient girls.
Exactly.
So, well, this is making so much more sense, and it makes me even angrier, and I'll just say it, angrier, of how much we lost through this Christian lens. I mean, the real beauty, the authenticity of life has really been stomped out through that Christian lens. And and I think about Constantine, you know, how Constantine, here we had all of these pagan groups, and you know, you don't, I at least I'm not aware of, you know, pagan groups who had crusades and fatwas and things like that, you know, killing other pagan groups. I mean, you know, just duality was accepted, nature was accepted, and then Constantine comes along and uses Christianity as a tool, you know, not because I seriously doubt, even though his mother was Christian, I understand from somebody he actually it was on his deathbed that he converted over to Christianity. All of his life, I think he spent it as a pagan. But he uses Christianity as this glue to solidify his empire. But look what he did. I mean, look at how he changed the direction of the rest of the world and what humanity has lost because of decisions like that.
And the philosophers and scholars and priests and people connected with temples, as the Christians came to power following Constantine, they said the same thing, Karen. They said, look at what we're losing. Look at what we've gained over so many centuries of human effort at looking at the universe and trying to figure out what the heck is going on, and look what we're losing. Now we're actually going backwards, and that's something I don't think people understand. People see history as a progression. You know, and we make it through ages, and we get more sophisticated, and we discover more. That's malarkey. There's a gap in Western history from about 400 A.D. Until, say, the at least 1200-1300, where things are going backwards. And
so we're talking about almost the Dark Ages.
Well, yeah, exactly. You can refer to it that way, sure. And that's why people have referred to it, because it's really a time when humanity stops progressing. I mean,
well, you know, you weren't with me at the beginning, but you having said that, I want to just reflect on something I said in the opening. I said, you know, based on some of these conversations you and I have been having, and a lot of the ideas guests bring to the show, you know, it's been making me think that the real frontier of discovery is not just in the cosmos or the ocean's depths. It's just rediscovering what's been lost, you know, what's been written out. Because we had it, so much of it all there, and we just sort of lost track of it, or it got stomped out to serve some agenda.
Exactly, and what's really a shame, and this is where I'm going to bash the women's studies and the classicists who do women's studies, historians who do women's studies, this is where they have so let us down. The greatest resource right now that we have are the documents that tell us what the women who were studying medicine, the earliest form of Western medicine, what they discovered about, say, the pharmacy, the pharmacology of all these crazy plants that they had mixed and put together and were able to control their cycles and were able to induce bleeding at will and were able to change their what we would call their menstrual cycle, to alter and affect their menstrual cycles. And it's pretty elegant pharmacology, by the way, that allowed them to do this. But they discovered these things. And a great example is breast cancer. I've read several. One is in Galen. And, of course, he's stealing it from the earlier pharmacology that the women set up. But he claimed that he had a concoction that was able to treat and had successfully treated breast cancer. Now, he may have been overstating that. He may have been inaccurate, but he also may have been onto something. That there are chemicals, or there are plants at least, that produce things, substances that we call chemicals now, that can actually have anti or can reverse cancer, or at least limit the spread of cancer. Things like this we don't study because we just don't want to. It's unbelievable that women haven't gotten up off their backsides and said, hey, why don't we look at what our ancestors, our female ancestors, were actually doing and figure out what is going on with this crazy science that they were able to figure out.
Wow. Well, we're going to get back to the movie, but one last question, because we probably have about 40 minutes. We can still talk about the movie. But I meant to ask you last week, are any of the pharmaceutical companies using any of the compounds from these ancient times? Or is it, as you just sort of alluded to, it's just sort of been written off as, you know, unimportant?
You know, the first thing we did in the 80s and 90s was run down to Central and South America and try to figure out what the indigenous populations had been using for drugs to fight various diseases, because scientists were figuring out, hey, there's a lot that they actually there's a lot of chemicals out there that these people have figured out actually work, and they have physiological effects on humans. So let's figure out what they're doing. Foolishly, we didn't go back and say, well, human beings have been progressing for how long, how many thousands of years, and why haven't we seen anything in the Western tradition about this? We just, it's laziness. I don't know what it's, I actually called, it's funny you ask, Karen, I actually called American Cancer Society, I think it was, when I was a grad student. I said, hey, I found several recipes that for drug combinations that people in antiquity claimed could treat different forms of cancer. And there's no doubt that the cancer level in antiquity was far, far lower. I studied this for years. Far, far lower than it is now, especially within the last 10 years in America. So,
your
you
response?
Know,
No response. Did they laugh at you?
thank you, but no thank you is essentially what the response was.
What arrogance. What arrogance.
Exactly. And that arrogance leads into another. That is what punishes. And this is what, and again, this is myth, and this goes right back into the movie. That arrogance is what punishes human beings. You know, if you don't want to respect nature, you may end up dying a lot earlier than you'd have to. That's kind of the message behind a lot of these gods, like Night. I want to talk about the goddess Night, because I don't think anybody really gives any respect or honor to to that tradition. But why don't we start with a movie, and I'll jump in with her when.
Okay. Well, okay, so Zeus, all right. You know, we were going to talk about who Zeus is, because I get the feeling there's more to Zeus than sort of, you know, meets our limited eye. And this lightning bolt of his, is that a metaphor for something? Or tell us about Zeus.
Yeah, just real quickly, because I can go on and talk about Zeus at length, because he's one of them that really ticks me off, because, again, we see him, and feminists are the ones who push this idea. Women's studies scholars push this, and I've sat in their lectures and listened to them push it. He is an example of the patriarchal god, right? He's the man who comes in, and he establishes order, and he takes his testicles and pushes everybody else around with his big testicles and his big lightning bolt. And that's just not the case. That's a complete misreading, and I'll tell you exactly why that's a complete misreading in one sentence. Zeus is neither male nor female.
He's androgynous?
There's a Dione. Okay, if we're going to talk about Zeus, there's a female equivalent in Greek, a female name that's Zeus as the female. So the sex doesn't matter with Zeus. And I think the best way to really lay out who Zeus is to look at what he means. It's just like Apollo. What does Apollo mean? What did Aphrodite mean? What did people worship when they worshipped Zeus?
What was their essence?
Exactly. See.
Okay.
Yeah. You got it. Exactly.
Okay. So what was Zeus's essence?
Yeah. Guest host.
Guest host.
That's all you need to know. Guest host. Zeus is the one that enables a guest and a host to coexist. It's almost biological. It's beautifully biological, as a matter of fact. A guest and a host. In other words, Zeus is the one that facilitated, in the Greek mind, he facilitated the modern age when we stopped, when we settled down in agricultural communities, and we all of a sudden had to have what? Laws, because we're all living stationary lives, and now we're starting to say, hey, can I steal something from person X, Y, or Z? And how do I deal with relationships with marriage and property and things like that? What do I do about things like that? Zeus is the one who facilitated that activity. I mean, historically, you can look at how the concept of Zeus came about. He's the one who facilitates the guest-host relationship. Without Zeus, you can't have civilization. You can't have people living in a free society that somehow gets along without destroying.
So in a sense, he's sort of, is he law and order also? He's sort of, he's organization, civilization. I mean, is he sort of this order over chaos kind of a thing?
If you have a farm and you have somebody traveling and there's no place to stay because it's 3,000 years ago, there's no hotels. What do you do? Somebody comes to your door.
Okay.
Do you kick them out? What do you do? No, in antiquity, unless you want to incur the wrath of Zeus, this god named Zeus, what you have to do is you have to feed them. You have to bathe them. Actually, I think you bathe them first. You have to bathe them. There's a whole process. Bathe them, feed them. And then you exchange information. You actually sit down and you drink and eat and take some drugs and talk about, relax, drink some opium, sit down and
so
relax.
So it's almost like civility.
Exactly.
Okay. All right, so Zeus is civility. So he's not this, well, I guess, you know, do the feminists, you know, get on him because he's always going around, raping this one and raping that one and pushing himself on people, you know,
again,
women?
Again, the Christian lens. But what is the nature of Zeus? Zeus brings together two foreign things into friendship. That's what he does. If you look at all of Zeus, of course Zeus is going to have 50 billion lovers. Why does he do that? You look at every myth about Zeus. Zeus is a union. He joins principles that normally wouldn't be joined together, that you have to have to create society.
So are you telling me they took that concept and turned it into forced intercourse?
Exactly.
That's insane.
Exactly.
Oh, what a distortion.
Right, exactly.
And oh, man.
And Christianity works to not only cement that distortion in concrete, but to make it into something hideous, makes it into something, you know, terrible. Anyway, that is the nature of Zeus. Artemis actually says it best, and there's a play, The Hippolytus. She says it best in The Hippolytus. She says, I cannot infringe upon the actions of another deity because of Zeus. He is the one who protects. Nobody steps on Aphrodite's toes. Nobody steps on Artemis's toes. Nobody messes with music. Nobody messes with the cosmos. Nobody messes with justice. Nobody. You don't step on another god's toes. You know why? Because Zeus will smack you if you do. Civilization itself will smack you if you do. That's where justice comes from. You have to respect the universal principles that guide life. And if they come in, and if Artemis and Aphrodite are not held in equal respect, you don't have understanding in life. You don't have counsel. And that's what Zeus was all about, bringing the gods together in a council. And again, back to the movie, you saw that counseling was so frigid and artificial in the movie. They all sat around looking at each other with their...
Well, you didn't even know who they were.
Exactly.
I mean, I'm thinking the woman, you know, that's talking to Poseidon and Zeus is Hera, and you find out, no, it's not Hera, it was Athena, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Exactly. And what are they doing? It looks like they're all sitting around just looking at each other being well-groomed, you know? They're all handsome people and everything.
It was like a beauty contest.
Exactly. And that's not what wisdom. You know what the Greeks, and I, you know, Gnostics give me a... I'm going to be the irate classes again, Karen. I hope I don't tick people off.
No, go ahead.
Gnostics really make me angry. They really make me angry because they're really Christians in sheep's clothing. And I think, and the reason I say this is because they worship wisdom, but I've never, ever, ever seen in any of my peripheral study of Gnosticism or listening to Gnostics or reading it on the internet, I've never, ever seen a definition of wisdom that matches antiquity's definition of wisdom. And that is, are you ready?
Yep.
Wisdom is the point at which the councils of the gods meet. What the heck does that mean? Right? It is the place at which, when you have a council, a civilization in which you have desire, in which you have what we would call virginity, but they didn't really consider it that, in which you have a desire, virginity, music, inspiration, all the elements come together to form what? Wisdom. When you get to the point that all of these things focus upon a single point in time and space, that's wisdom. That single point is wisdom, according to the Greek mind. When you've taken into account, let me state it differently, because that's contorted. When you come to a point of realization where you are able to understand things as diverse as, where you see that desire and music and harmony and balance, where these come together and you understand that, you see it with your eyes, that's wisdom.
And so what I'm thinking here, it's sort of extrapolating forward, and if I'm off base, that's okay, tell me, I don't care. That's what they were seeking. And I don't recall, as I was raised a Catholic, anybody ever telling me wisdom was what I was seeking.
Yes, no, because you're supposed to, it's all written down already. Some dude 2,000 years ago figured it out. He wrote it down now. You're supposed to believe it, and if you don't, then you're...
Well, and I don't recall that, you know, that there was anything about understanding any of these ideas of the Greeks or even achieving wisdom was a goal.
Right.
I mean, it was more about, you know, sacrificing and obeying and maybe you'll reap your reward in the next life kind of a thing.
Exactly. Why understand the moon? You know, there's no reason for us to sit and figure out how many days is a lunar cycle, you know, and why is it about 28 days? Why is it that the human and simian menstrual cycles are roughly, you know, approximating the lunar cycle? Why is it that upright monkeys, for some reason, have some sort of attachment to... Is there a reason that there's an attachment there? is there something about the full moon that's different from the moon not being full for animals? Well, sure, you ask any biologist, the effects that the moon has on predators, nighttime predators, and, you know, hey, even its pole, the magnetic pole of the moon that creates tides, you know, that how much effect does the moon have on nature? Well, what you just said is what Christianity exactly teaches. You don't need to know any of that. And
well, and I mean, you think about the Pope. The Pope just freaked out over the movie Avatar, saying revering nature can never replace religion. Where if we, I mean, I'm just thinking, you know, if we had continued to revere nature, our interconnectedness to this, you know, to this cosmos that we, you know, this blue marble that we live on, would we be facing global warming and all of these other things? You know, our toxic environment, disease. I mean, you know, we were so led astray. I mean, what an egregious sin, you know, has been perpetrated upon humanity.
Exactly. And like you said, would we be in the position that we are today? And that's exactly what the understanding of the goddess Night was all about. That's what Black Night is all about. Black Night's daughters are the fates. Black Night's daughter is Nemesis. Black Night's son is Death, you know. And she gives nighttime, reaches in and gives to humanity the images she gives to humanity, exactly what humanity deserves. And if your society decides to ignore nature, guess what? Punishment's coming in whatever form. You know, you can, you know, stated simply, you can eat that poisonous plant if you want, even though you've seen your friends die from it. But if you're not going to follow nature and you're not going to study nature and you're going to eat it anyway because you're ignorant, well, then you deserve to die.
So if you're not going to respect it, then if this isn't a reflection of what we're faced with today, if you aren't going to see it and respect it, then you made your bed. You're going to reap the reward. It's retribution.
Exactly. And I think that's what Christianity tries to fight. That's what Christianity tries to portray as being the complete opposite of what it is, that you can overcome nature, that you don't need a sex drive, that you don't need desire, that you don't need to control your menstrual cycle, that you don't need to perform contraception or abortion. This is what, I can't believe this, Karen, and you can tell me what you think, but we're getting off the subject, but birth control was so huge in antiquity that the idea of not being able to control your own reproductivity, well, then what does that make you if you can't? It makes you unnatural. Everything about selection, genetic selection, is about choice. It's about saying, no, I choose not to follow this path. That's what nature does. She chooses not to follow certain paths, and that's the same for a woman. When a woman decides to abort a fetus or to use contraception to prevent implantation, that's a choice. That's a genetic choice.
Well, when you consider, I mean, it wasn't that long ago Christianity was trying to decide if women even had souls. I think we can see that, you know, they didn't think that choice should be in women's hands anymore. You know, that was just too much power for us.
Exactly. I think that's the key, is power. And you always come back to I think that's your gift, Karen. One of your gifts is that you always come back to the, like, you hit at the heart of the matter. I dance around things more. You hit at the heart of the matter, and that's exactly the heart.
Oh, this is really awesome stuff. So, going back to Zeus's lightning bolt, was his lightning bolt, was that a metaphor for something?
Yeah, it's the one tool of Zeus. Remember, who gave, when people ask about the bolt, who gave? And again, the movie, what is it? It was an American Christian version of the Greek idea. So what did the bolt end up in the movie? It was a tool of destruction. It was a gun, you know. It was his big gun that Zeus is going to point at the rest of the world. And, you know, if somebody steals it, well, they got the big gun. And we got a, you know, it's like an atomic bomb. And there couldn't be anything further from the truth about the bolt of Zeus. Who gave that bolt to Zeus? You know, who enabled him? It's actually Earth. It's actually Gaia. You know, your listeners should know this. It's actually Gaia who was hiding that bolt within herself. She is the preeminent, the first oracular divinity. You know, there's no Greek in his right mind who doesn't worship Gaia before anybody else. And that the fact of this that's shown is the oracle at Delphi is originally an oracle to Gaia. It is the flash of brilliance. It is the, what is it that distinguishes civilization from non-civilization? The flash of brilliance. It is that moment, that understanding where nature all comes together. It's let me give you an example. When the bolt hits the ground, the Greeks and Romans taught that when lightning strikes the ground, mushrooms grow. It causes mushrooms to grow. And not just any plain old mushrooms, but Dr. Carl Ruck has written about this as well several times, that those mushrooms are often used in cult ritual and practice to induce psychotropics. You know, they're psychotropic substances that induce altered states of consciousness. And so there's actually an early on connection with the cult of Gaia, that they were using the bolt of Zeus, you know, this production of a plant that was, or excuse me, of a fungus that's able to alter human consciousness. So the bolt becomes actually a method of realization. It's not a weapon. It's a method of realization. Now, you can describe it as a weapon. That's fine. But it's a way, it's something that civilization produces. It's, you know, when Zeus saves his siblings, when he chooses to preserve the cosmos rather than dominate it. You know, Christianity dominates. The Greek religions were defensive means of preserving nature, not of dominating it. So when you preserve it and you come together in council, do you see where I'm going? You come together in the council of the gods, you suddenly have an awareness that you don't. Nature gives you an awareness. Gaia gives you an awareness that you don't have. That's the bolt. That is the bolt that gives, you know, Zeus is known for his counsel. That's what he's known for. Where did he get his counsel? Because he joins himself with all of these forces like Maya, you know, and like Themis. Oh, isn't that nice? Who's his counselor? Themis. Oh, my God. It's beautiful stuff. I don't know. It's... Now I'm just moving.
Well, so what you're saying, David, I think, is, okay, so they take the lightning bolt, which is this very, it seems like this positive force for good, and they turn it into this patriarchal weapon of war.
Exactly.
It's almost like, let's not revere knowledge and enlightenment, because then that would put maybe too much knowledge in the hands of the people. Let's instead distort it and give us something that we can use to have power and control. And am I, like, you know, just being too feminist here or something, or am I seeing the shift properly?
No, you're not being feminist at all. You're understanding what the nature of what they were talking about, nature with a big N. And that's, you know, you have a connection with that, and you're able to understand. It's almost like you have a similar mindset as people did in antiquity.
So could we also draw a parallel to Genesis, when we're not supposed to eat from the tree of knowledge, and the ramifications is all this grief and the suffering of women and blah, 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 blah. I mean, is it almost the sort of the same thing? They distort the tree of knowledge in Genesis, just like the lightning bolt gets distorted?
Very much so, very much so. Yeah, what is that stupid tree, and what is, you know, what is going on with the fruit?
Well, there's this ugly snake draped around it, and you know how evil snakes are.
Exactly. And what's so despicable about that is there are plenty of trees with golden fruit and snakes that guard them in antiquity. It's a common theme in antiquity. The only funny thing is in the Judeo-Christian tradition, with the Christians having lifted the Jewish tradition, the snake is a bad thing. It becomes a negative. But for the Greeks, that snake was an oracular vessel. It was a means. It was actually a means for you accessing that fruit. You know, and who puts those snakes? Who is able to conquer those? Or excuse me, who is able to facilitate those snakes? It's always women. Always female priestesses that we have turned into witches. We call them witches. They're these pharmacists. They're these people like Medea, and there are these people. You know, Medea is able to put the snake to sleep. She's able to charm it. We say put it to sleep, but really the Greek is she charms it. She charms it and then has access to that fruit. And to the Greeks, that was life and beautiful. To the Christians, that was a no-no. You know, you don't go through women. You don't go through, for Christ's sake, don't go through women because they're corrupt. And don't go through snakes because that's what is able to lead these corrupt women along. Well, all these oracular cults in antiquity were using snakes in order to, you know, they were harvesting venom in order to treat women medicinally.
Well, I'm thinking, I'm remembering now when we were actually on the at the Parthenon, and right across from the Parthenon, that smaller building, I remember reading something about it. They used to keep snakes there.
Sure. And
Erechtheion or something like that.
Erechtheion, yeah. Uh-huh. The Erechtheion, sure. And so go ahead, finish.
Well, also too about Zeus. You sort of teased me in one of your emails when we were talking about our conversation tonight, and you said who is the one immortal that Zeus, whom Zeus has no authority over?
Yeah, did you figure that out?
No, I don't think so. An immortal. Well, would it be Gaia?
That's a good guess, but that she's not actually. There's only one that he will not. He won't pursue punishment. He won't pursue any sort of vindicate. He's actually afraid. There's only one goddess that he's afraid of, and that's Night, isn't it?
Ah, because she's retribution. If he's a bad boy, you know, if he doesn't. I'm personifying. I'm making him a person again.
No, you're doing for you. That's fine. No, keep going though. Yeah, if he's a bad boy, if he doesn't, Zeus knows that he can't. Civilization knows that it has to follow the rules. There's an older rule that's set by a goddess we call Night, Black Night. You know, sometimes she's got epithets like Black Night or Destructive Night. She brings destruction. She's the only goddess that even brings destruction to immortals. She brings destruction to immortals and mortals alike. So when Zeus is fooled by her son, Sleep, she has a son named Sleep, and he puts Zeus to sleep, and Zeus is pissed off, so he pursues Sleep. But he stops. Why? Because Sleep is the son of Night. And he refuses to ever have any sort of, the hymn says specifically, he refuses to anger Night. You can't anger Night because he respects this earlier tradition that is pre-civilization, that is kind of this idea that, hey, Nemesis is out there. The fates are out there. They spin your life. Your life is a story. The Greeks didn't think you lived in an after, that you got a reward or punishment came primarily in an afterlife. It was all about here and now. Your life is a story, and the fates are spinning it. And if you do certain things, you get certain things. You deserve certain things. You get certain, you get your comeuppance. Nature doesn't let you not get your comeuppance.
So really, then, the ultimate authority of everything is divine law, in a way. In a way, I guess that's how I'm sort of seeing Night, divine natural law.
Exactly. Maybe cosmic law would be a better word.
Cosmic law.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. Right.
So,
exactly. Because it's universal because there's another galaxy out there, right? And I always use this example: our two galaxies are going to collide, and you get, you know, after the Milky Way and the Andromeda Galaxy destroy each other, they'll create a larger galaxy in about 5 billion years. And that larger galaxy will have spin-off planets, solar systems, and planets. And those planets will be seeded with the right elements that will ultimately evolve into some priestess who is able to play an instrument and inspire somebody else with poetry. And that poetry is immortal. That singing is immortal. That voice is immortal. They understood that. They understood that there was a cosmic rule that you just can't. That's the way it is.
Well, you know, you're making me wonder about that. Have you heard of like the ancient Egyptian musical instrument, magical instrument, the sistrum?
Yes, I've heard. I don't know anything about it, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, Plutarch said, when you shook the sistrum, you kept the energies of the universe flowing. That was one of the things they said. I mean, it was used as a musical instrument. It was used to dispel negative energy, lots of different things, magical stuff. And I'm starting to wonder if, I mean, I've never really taken the time to research it, but it's making me think that this was, really a lot more powerful than just these surface things that I've said. You know, it may be it almost, because, you know, with the Greeks and the Egyptians, I mean, they were pretty closely, close together and learned from each other. I wonder if there's some sort of tie-in there or something.
Oh, definitely. There's got to be because, you know, Zeus Amon is he's the Zeus of Egypt, essentially. And, yeah, the fact that the Greeks recognized readily that they stole much of their culture from the Egypt from their southern neighbors. That's no doubt. So this sistrum there, yeah. No, you know, why use music to heal somebody? Like you say, to talk about improving energies or casting out bad energies. Why use music to heal? The Greeks did the same thing, you know. And there's they're pretty much. I don't think there's a culture that exists that doesn't connect music and healing. And you know, why is that?
Well, and I know when we were on our tour to Greece and even in Turkey, where you still had, you know, a lot of the Greek and Roman influence, these temples of Asclepius, you know, they used all of these sort of what we would recognize as New Age treatments, some of which were healing with music or dream incubation and, you know, all of these sort of woo-woo things, you know, that Western medicine would just roll their eyes about. But
right.
But you know, here, you know, they were keeping in sync with, you know, the sort of the cosmic laws, in a sense.
Exactly. And they were involved with snakes as well at the temples of Asclepius. And, you know, why were they? And why was women's medicine? What's an incubation, you know? Why go sit in a temple and have some priestess come in and burn a bunch of funny herbs in a very small enclosure while you sit there and suck in the smoke? Why have her do that? And then you have a dream about a snake, and all the snakes that are connected with the temple, they're allowed to roam freely because they're considered sacred. And how do you get some sort of vision of these snakes, you know? It's all, Karen, it's all so amazingly well connected. What the priests and priestesses did in antiquity was such an advancement for humankind. It's just a shame that we don't give them any credit. And coming back to the feminists, that's why feminists should be ashamed of themselves, because they've missed one of the greatest contributions that women have made to society almost entirely.
Well, you're throwing down the gauntlet here, David. maybe some feminist scholars are listening, and you know, maybe they have done some of this work and we don't know about it, in which case, you know, I apologize. Please let me hear from you. We'll give you your due. Or if not, if it's as you say, then, you know, maybe this could be an area of study that really deserves to be looked at.
It should. It should. And you could. There is so much you could learn from it. And I welcome feminists, or women's studies scholars, anybody who has a background in this area, to, you know, call, to participate, call you or email you and tell you how it is that, you know, how it is that we haven't missed the boat. But guess what, ladies? We have missed the boat. We've missed the boat entirely. And the shame that we should feel is people in universities who prance around in women's studies departments and believe they teach those girls that are coming into their courses. I'm going to specifically isolate the girls because I guest lectured in a women's studies course. I took those girls some real meat. I took them the stuff that, you know, their ancestors were actually working on. Like, I dare you, Karen, to ask any of your women's studies guests how you control your menstruation. I dare you to ask them, hey, if you're living 2,500 years ago, what kind of drugs do you use to induce an abortion? I'm not going to curse. Not a one of them is going to be able to tell you. Not a one of them. And why? Because they have neglected their field entirely. They would rather sit around and talk about Zeus's patriarchy, totally ignoring the fact that these same Greeks got down on their hands and knees or swore oaths to women.
Wow. That needs to be emphasized, underlined in big red letters.
Exactly.
Well, David, this has been fun, and we're going to have you back on in April. You and I will figure out a day that works for us in April. And I thank you so very much. I mean, I know just from all the emails I got from your show last week, and I anticipate again this week, you are really striking a chord out there with the listeners. They are just eating this up as much as I am. Even some of the people that were in my Capes for the Queen of Heaven class were saying, wow, we wish this guy David could come, teach a semester here and just sort of, bring us all up to date and tell us what we're missing, so thank you so very much for what you're doing. I know sometimes it probably doesn't feel like it's appreciated, but I mean, I know I feel like that sometimes. You never really know until the emails start coming in and you get validation that the effort you're putting out is really helping somebody or piquing somebody's interest, or and in some cases a catalyst for them maybe doing something important. So thank you so very much for taking the time, because you've dedicated a lot of time to the show, and I really appreciate it.
Well, if your audience can understand it, if the women, let me isolate them, if the women in your audience could understand exactly how beautiful their tradition is, they themselves would be irate at their teachers. They would be irate and say, why did you cause us to miss this? What pride in you? It would cause you to miss this. How can night bring your nemesis? The women that listen to your show need to know exactly how beautiful their tradition is, and it's far. I'm just studying it peripherally, just through the pharmacology, and I can tell you what women have done for human civilization has been completely overlooked. It has been overlooked, it has been buried, and it has been ignored by women scholars, and that your women out there should be livid, and they should be demanding to know this stuff. They should be demanding to know it, because it is so incredibly, when I get a couple of emails from people who go over this material, and they're like, wow, look at these sources, and they say, well, that makes sense, and that's beautiful, and their eyes are opened, and it's almost like nature enlivens them. It makes them alive again, and suddenly they realize the significance of their own existence, their own bodies, for Christ's sake, their own genes.
Well, I guess, they're living in this culture too. They have suffered under the patriarchy as well. And, I know a lot of them, this is really important to them, and they've dedicated their life's work to it. And I can't be quite as hard on them as you are. I really can't. But I hear what you're saying. I mean, this information you're bringing is so important. And I think, expand it beyond just the scholars. Just women in general, Christian women, Islamic women, pagan women. If women everywhere could hear this stuff, I think it. It's like when we talk about this, it gives us permission to stand 2 inches taller. To not fall prey to the programming that we're less than, that we're second class citizens. I always tell my students, look, it doesn't matter, what was in history. We're not doomed to repeat the past. We can choose what our future is going to be, but we can point to the past. We can point to a time when things really were different. And, so we have the past as our ally, as well as what we want to make our future. And that's why
what you do is so important. And that's why, because you're standing in the front ranks, actually. Those scholars believe they're in the front ranks, and that's because they have hubris. But you don't.
Well, they have PhDs. I don't.
Yeah, PhD is just another word for hubris. I've got one, and I can tell you, it's just another word for pride. That's all. But, Karen, what you're doing is so important, and I hope your audience understands that. And, yeah, you don't have to be as angry at them as I do, because I have a grudge to bear with them.
Well, lots of them are my friends and mentors. So, I do respect a lot of these women. They've taught me so much of what I know. And I know, like I said, it is really, a lot of them have dedicated their entire lives to this. Look at Maria Gimbutas, for instance, and they've just been – denigrated instead of, revered for their work. I mean, just like you. I mean, look what happened to you when you tried to bring the truth of, you know, of drug use in antiquity. You know, there's such an oppression out there, you know, this machine that wants to quash anything but the status quo. And I know they felt that, you know, look, it takes everybody. You know, you're contributing what you're contributing and, you know, they're contributing all they've contributed. And, you know, we all care about it. We all love it. And I know you're a lover of woman and goddess. And, you know, like you said, you're a servant of the muses. And I can hear your passion and I'm so glad for it because you've taught me so much and I appreciate that.
Well, to be able to speak to your audience is a real honor for me, and I thank every minute that you asked me to come on the show is a breath of fresh air, Karen, and you're a breath of fresh air, and I hope your audience understands that.
Well, you are always welcome back, and like I said, we'll pick a date in April, and we'll have some more interesting things to talk about.
Fantastic.
So thank you very, very much, David, and stay warm. You're in frozen Wisconsin, aren't you?
That's right. We're in Wisconsin and frozen. The ground has to be frozen over for a certain time of year, and you know what? That's a good thing. But as a mammal, I kind of enjoy the heat. So.
Well, I hate to tell you, here in Venice Beach, it's been like a spring day here today. So.
Oh man.
All right. Well, I'm going to have to say goodnight.
Thank you, Karen.
Well, listeners, to finish out February, next week our guest is going to be Foremother Christina Biaggi, expert on goddess and Paleolithic and Neolithic cultures. Some of the stuff we're going to address are the goddess mound and her derivatives. And it was you that asked, where are the Foremothers and Wayshowers? And they are here every week, usually on Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Pacific, generously giving more of their time for you to hear what's stoking their passions these days. And I hope you've stayed with me for the last 2 hours. I think it's been a fun show. Phyllis Chesler and David Hillman, they've been great guests, and I appreciate both of their scholarship and activism. Now, remember, here on Blog Talk, we can take your caller questions. So in the future, if you'd like, dial in and ask questions toward the end of the interviews for our guests, or even after my What's the Buzz segment. You can call in at 718-766-4662. Write that down for next week and weeks ahead. And you can also email me questions in advance if you don't want to talk on the show. And please, if you're a fan, please indicate that by selecting us as a favorite on Blog Talk Radio. Well, listeners, that is about all for tonight. We are out of time, and I guess I'll say goodnight until next Wednesday. May the great She embrace you in her golden wings. And as we have about 2 minutes left on the show, I am going to leave you listening to Golden Age by the Dragon Ritual Drummers. Good night, listeners. Have a great week, and come back next Wednesday.